be part of the Manhattan Project, basically. And, you know, that was 3,000 ton, 70% high-grade uranium. Half of that was still above ground when Lumumba took power. So that was part of the equation, what was going on in Katanga.
That's Belgian filmmaker Johan Grimompré, director of Soundtrack to a Coup d'État, which has been nominated for an Academy Award for Best Documentary. Told entirely through archival footage, the film's a sweeping story of the events leading up to the assassination of the Congolese independence leader, first Prime Minister Patrice Lumumba. To see the whole interview, go to democracynow.org. You can also see other interviews Democracy Now! Has conducted about other films nominated for this year's Oscar, including the Palestinian-Israeli film No Other Land, also nominated for Best Documentary about the Palestinian community of Masafer Yatta, which was recently attacked by Israeli settlers. There's also the best short documentary, I Am Ready, Warden, about the death penalty that began when a Texas man asked journalist Kerry Blakinger to witness his execution. And The Apprentice, nominated for Best Actor and Best Supporting Actor, the film many say Trump doesn't want you to see, that looks at how Trump was mentored by Roy Cohen, former chief counsel to Senator Joseph McCarthy during the Red Scare. He mentored as he built his New York real estate empire. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
We'd like you to meet a friend of ours.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday of the month at 5:30 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found at our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Prison Pipeline is a radio program dedicated to educating the public about the Oregon criminal justice system. Topics include incarceration and reentry, addictions and mental health, elections and laws, victims' rights, and criminal justice reform. The program presents a unique understanding of the criminal justice system, addresses the root causes of crime, and challenges the status quo. It seeks to promote awareness and activism in order to foster a safer, healthier, and more just society.
Prison Pipeline airs on Monday evenings from 6:30 to 7 p.m. on KBOO Portland. Check us out every week. If you miss an episode, you can stream it later. Just go to kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. More info about upcoming shows and events related to the prison community can be found on our Facebook page, Prison Pipeline. Be sure to like us.
Support for KBOO comes from KBOO members and Grendel's Coffee Shop, located at East Burnside and 8th Avenue in Portland, featuring coffee, tea, sandwiches, and more. Information at grendelspdx.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, hundreds rally in Portland against President Trump and Elon Musk.
Providence Health will return to bargaining with unionized nurses through mediation.
And Oregon lawmakers consider a freeze on new factory farms in polluted regions.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, February 17th, 2025. I'm Sam Bowman.
And I'm Kate Chase. Protesters gathered in cities across the region on President's Day to protest President Trump and billionaire Elon Musk. Rallies were held in Vancouver, Salem, and Portland as part of a nationwide effort called 50 States, 50 Protests, One Day. KBOO's Althea Billings reports from Portland.
The third Monday in February is typically celebrated as President's Day in the United States. But it marked a different occasion for the hundreds assembled outside Portland City Hall on Monday afternoon.
Stop the kill! Stop the kill! Stop the kill!
The crowd instead gathered for a Not My President's Day rally in March, sporting homemade signs aimed at President Donald Trump, billionaire Elon Musk, and the Department of Governmental Efficiency, or DOGE.
Elon Musk has got to go, hey, hey! Almost! Elon Musk has got to go, hey, hey!
Some signs read, "No kings, no fascists. We did not vote for Elon Musk," and "Get your sticky fingers off our democracy."
Freedom ring! No king!
Freedom ring!
No king!
Freedom ring!
No king!
One protester, Melissa, intended to fill a dummy wearing a Trump mask with helium.
However, this morning, disappointed when I found out that it was too heavy.
Instead, she rigged the dummy to a pole, and it could be seen swaying among the protest signs. Melissa says a protest isn't enough.
I think we're going to have to get a little more forceful with our resistance.
She says an economic blackout on February 28th is intended to make big businesses feel the impact that individual consumers have on their bottom line.
That means like boycotting large industries. You can shop at mom and pop shops to get your supplies. And also not purchasing things that are not necessary right now, you know? You don't need a new pair of jeans right now, you know? Things that we can pass on, you know? The absolute necessities, sure. But like I said, mom and pops, you know? We got to shut down these major corporations because they're running the show.
Suzanne Thorson is a retired healthcare worker from Portland.
Us 70-year-olds have lived through a lot. I think there has to be a revolution to make that change. And I'm so excited to see all the people out here.
Her sign was inspired by Oregon Senator Jeff Merkley, who, alongside other Senate Democrats, held the Senate floor overnight in early February in protest against Trump's cabinet picks.
And he said, you know, MAGA Republicans are trying to control us. Do you want that? Hell no. And that was Merkley, our wonderful senator. You know, so we want to decide our own futures. Do you want Republicans? Do you want Elon Musk? Do you want Trump to decide your future? Hell no.
Greg Weber made a sign that read, "Just say no to fascism." And there wasn't just one thing that inspired Weber to participate.
It's not one thing. It's just the whole bludgeoning, just trying to test the patience and test the boundaries, that test the resistance of these institutions. And yeah, so I can't say there's one thing. I mean, just his mere existence, if I could sum it up, just his mere existence. And that we're here again, 8 years later, having to do this again. That doesn't respect reproductive rights, female rights, trans rights, people who are not Christian. And it's just absolutely outrageous how the structure of our government, our institutions have been failing us.
Weber acknowledged that protest alone wouldn't be enough to change the trajectory of national politics.
I don't know if this is actually going to accomplish anything now, but we need to keep it up. We can't give up. And it's just nonstop banging against the wall until the wall falls.
For KBOO News, I'm Althea Billings.
The healthcare giant Providence has agreed to come back to the bargaining table with unionized nurses who have been striking for over a month. It's been over a week since nurses with the Oregon Nurses Association rejected a tentative agreement with Providence. 5,000 nurses are still on strike, and they say they rejected the agreement because it didn't offer them competitive pay or improve their working conditions, namely their staffing levels. The striking nurses work at 8 hospitals across Oregon. Mediation between Providence and the Nurses Association will be on Tuesday and Wednesday. 11 Portland City Councilors signed a letter calling on the healthcare company to return to bargaining with the nurses. District 3 Councilor Tiffany Koyama Lane said this in a video message.
I'm here at Providence Portland right now because our healthcare workers are a huge part of the backbone of our community. And for far too long, they have been asked to work in unsustainable conditions. This is not just about wages. This is about making sure that the healthcare providers who take care of our community have what they need to take care of us safely. Providence has chosen to spend millions and millions of dollars each week to pay for strike-breaking replacement nurses instead of actually coming to the table and spending that money in ways that can benefit the community here. Portland City Councilors wrote and signed this letter to show that we stand in solidarity with the thousands of healthcare workers who bravely are on strike right now to fight for what they need to take care of our community. Providence, it's time to show up to the table and bargain in good faith. These healthcare workers give everything to their patients. It is time to show that you value the healthcare workers in return.
That was Portland District 3 Councilor Tiffany Koyama-Lane. District 4 Councilor Eric Zimmerman was the only council member not to sign the letter supporting the striking nurses. Other elected leaders have called on Providence to give the nurses a fair contract and end the strike, including Governor Tina Kotek. Mediation starts Tuesday, and it will be the first time the parties have met to bargain in 2 weeks.
Oregon advocates for clean water say the state needs to stop the expansion of factory farms in order to protect groundwater. They say a moratorium would give the state time to clean up Oregon's groundwater management areas, which consistently test high for nitrate. Isabel Charlet reports.
Oregon lawmakers are considering a moratorium on permits for new or expanding factory farms in some of the state's most polluted areas. A coalition known as Stand Up to Factory Farms says, along with groundwater pollution, the ongoing expansion of factory farms in Oregon has resulted in dangerous air pollution, exploitation of workers, and a loss of family farms. The coalition's Amy Van Son says Oregon's groundwater management areas already have high levels of nitrate contamination from factory farms, and a moratorium would give the state time to address the problem.
This has just been an ongoing public health crisis for decades. Let's not make it any worse than it already is.
While livestock numbers remain stable, Van Son notes a decline in small and mid-sized dairies in Oregon, which has led to increased concentration of waste at bigger facilities. The Lower Umatilla Groundwater Management Area hosts one of the nation's largest mega dairies, Three Mile Canyon Farms, which holds up to 90,000 cattle. Along with protecting Oregon's drinking water, Van Son says the state needs to slow the spread of factory farms to protect the climate. Research shows animal agriculture generates nearly 15% of total global greenhouse gas emissions, which is greater than all transportation emissions combined.
Food and agriculture production especially is often overlooked when we look at how to reduce our emissions.
Oregon has three groundwater management areas, Northern Malheur County, the Southern Willamette Valley, and the Umatilla Basin in North Central Oregon. Together, these areas measure nearly 1,000 square miles. The moratorium is a follow-up request to a bill passed in 2023 regulating factory farms in the state. I'm Isabel Charlet, Oregon News Service.
Top Trump officials are set to meet with Russian officials in Saudi Arabia over the Ukraine war. Also, the GOP budget resolution is at risk as moderates weigh out consequences. And New York City Mayor Eric Adams says he's, quote, going nowhere. With more on these stories, it's Alex Gonzalez with 2025 Talks.
Welcome to 2025 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Literally, President Trump wrote the art of the deal. He knows how to negotiate, and I believe if we will trust the process, he will be able to negotiate a peace deal for both countries.
Oklahoma Republican Senator Mark Wayne Mullen says he's confident President Donald Trump can broker a peace deal between Russia and Ukraine. Administration officials, including Secretary of State Marco Rubio, are set to meet with Russian negotiators in Saudi Arabia. Neither Ukraine or the European Union will be represented. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says they won't accept any peace deal reached without them.
So I will never accept any decisions between the United States and Russia about Ukraine. Never. And our people, never.
The White House says granting the U.S. rights to Ukraine's large deposits of earth minerals could sway American favor. The minerals are used in consumer electronics, electric vehicles, and military hardware. Trump has also cited them as a reason for taking control of Greenland. A Republican-controlled House committee voted on party lines to advance a budget resolution, though it may not have the votes to reach the Senate. It could increase the deficit by $500 billion over 10 years, including new spending on defense and the border. But at least two moderate House Republicans say they oppose its cuts to Medicare, Medicaid, and food benefits to pay for extending high-income tax cuts. According to the Immigration Policy Tracking Project, the Trump administration has already taken 130 actions on immigration. Mary Poole with the Refugee Resettlement Agency in Montana says advocates are scrambling to keep up.
This rapid removal of humanitarian protections, that's one thing that's really scary for folks. Many people came here through this new legal pathway that Biden created, and it might just be deemed null and void.
Two immigration bills are also advancing at the Montana legislature. One would require police to check and report someone's immigration status during any lawful stop. The other would let the state bring criminal charges against anyone in immigrant detention, previously treated as a civil issue. Minnesota Democratic Senator Tina Smith's decision not to run for re-election may clear a path for governor and VP candidate Tim Walz, but it comes after Michigan Democratic Senator Gary Peters also said he won't seek another term. Finally, Democrats are calling for New York Governor Kathy Hochul to remove New York City Mayor Eric Adams from office after the Justice Department dropped charges against him. Several federal prosecutors resigned to protest a move Hochul says was deeply corrupt.
This is unbelievably unprecedented for the Department of Justice in Washington to interfere in this way. You look at what happened here. This is not supposed to happen in our system of justice.
Adams did not attend the weekend's annual legislative caucus in Albany, but at a Queen's Church appearance said he's not going anywhere. I'm Alex Gonzalez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
The nation could face sharp impacts from President Donald Trump's pause on external health communications. It comes as states are tracking cases of bird flu in humans, animals, plus some national reports of cases in humans. A third person was hospitalized for the illness in Wyoming. Edwin J. Vieira has more on what the pause on health communications means for people from Connecticut.
Connecticut could soon see the effects of President Donald Trump's decision to pause government health agencies' external communications. The executive order halts regular updates on health advisories and scientific reports from agencies like the Department of Health and Human Services and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. This comes as Connecticut has had two bird flu outbreaks in backyard poultry flocks. Sarah Sorcher with the Center for Science in the Public Interest says there will still be breaking or emergency news alerts regarding outbreaks.
So it is important for consumers to still check the news. You can follow these agencies on social media, and there will be communications about outbreaks moving forward. I do think it's important for members of the public to speak out and express concern, write to your members of Congress, write to the president, and speak up for science.
Trust in most health agencies has declined since the pandemic. Even as Trump and his new Secretary of Health and Human Services say they'll make America healthy again, there's plenty of pessimism among Americans. A new Gallup poll shows most voters don't think healthcare is a priority for the second Trump administration. Pausing government health agencies' external communications comes as their funding has also been frozen. Daniel Moriarty in the University of Pennsylvania Psychology Department notes immunocompromised people benefit from having this information. He says these agencies are responsible for more than the public may realize.
In addition to funding research and funding scientists and academics, there's a real service for up-to-date information that's communicated en masse from people who are specifically tracking how health trends are shifting and how different potential viruses or illnesses are popping up and evolving.
Freezing funding for the National Institutes of Health also stops free clinical care from the agency's clinical trials in hospitals and academic centers nationwide. This is Edwin J. Vieira for Connecticut News Service.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Coast Range Radio. At 6, it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, a special rebroadcast of the KBOO-produced series, It Did Happen Here. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with an overnight low of 43 degrees. Tomorrow, those clouds continue with a high of 52. Today in history, in 2008, Kosovo declared independence from Serbia. The quote of the day is from U.S. President Dwight Eisenhower, who said, quote, "What counts is not necessarily the size of the dog in the fight. It's the size of the fight in the dog."
Trump laid off hundreds from the Indian Health Service as part of his purge of federal workers. But after tribes intervened, nearly 1,000 were walked back. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Nearly 1,000 Indian Health Service layoffs were rescinded Friday as tribal organizations from across the country advocate to protect the federal workforce serving Indian country. The layoffs are part of the Trump administration's effort to shrink the size of the federal workforce. More than a dozen tribal organizations sent a letter to the Office of Personnel Management and the administration on Friday, urging for the protection of federal employees serving Indian country. The letter raises concerns about what they say would be devastating impacts on essential services in tribal communities, including critical service disruption to healthcare and emergency services, and jobs with ripple effects on local economies. The groups are calling for full exemptions for employees in the Indian Health Service, Bureau of Indian Affairs, Bureau of Indian Education, and other federal offices that support tribes. The National Indian Health Board is among organizations to sign the letter. The group told Native News Online Sunday that the IHS layoffs were rescinded thanks at least in part to advocacy by the many tribal organizations. ICT Reports' new Health Secretary, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., verbally rescinded the IHS layoffs Friday evening. Tribal organizations are reminding officials that tribes have unique political status and the government has trust and treaty obligations. A recent report shows that in rural communities home to large numbers of American Indians, including in Montana, people are more likely to rely on Medicaid for health insurance across all ages. Kathleen Shannon has more.
About 23% of Montanans rely on Medicaid for their health coverage, but the four counties with the highest rates, roughly 40%, are all home to American Indian reservations. That's according to a report from the Georgetown Center for Children and Families on Medicaid's role in rural areas. Executive Director Joan Alker says that's a national pattern.
This is important because if Congress moves ahead to make large cuts, these areas and Indian country more generally will be in big trouble.
Alker says documents leaked from the House Budget Committee show it's considering cuts to Medicaid between $200 billion and $2.3 trillion. She adds the cuts are not a foregone conclusion. Jason Smith, executive director of the Montana Consortium for Urban Indian Health, says Medicaid provides health coverage for individuals while being a critical source of revenue for the urban Indian organizations to help sustain their operations.
I would say for the UIOs, particularly, had a lot of revenue coming from Medicaid, so it's really a great secondary source of funding that has helped their organizations run and provide services for the communities.
As of January, more than 14,000 American Indians in Montana were enrolled in Medicaid expansion. I'm Kathleen Shannon.
An effort to improve response to reports of missing and murdered Indigenous people in Oregon is underway in the state legislature. KLCC's Brian Bull reports.
State Representative Tana Sanchez is building on a 2019 MMIP bill she sponsored that created talking sessions between tribal communities and state agencies, including the Oregon State Police. That led to improved training and a tribal liaison in the OSP. Now Sanchez has a bill that aims to have Oregon's 9 federally recognized tribes and urban communities partner up with another state agency.
It's asking that we put a sort of intervention kind of situation in the Oregon Health Authority. They've already got established prevention models that they use. They already have the ability to get out to community. They already have the ability to bring folks into that thought process of, like, how do we fix this?
The bill is currently in front of the legislature's budget writing committee with an estimated price tag of $500,000 per year. She's concerned about whether federal funds could be tapped, given the uncertainty about the future of federal spending. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Visitors to Sovi Island will no longer be able to buy parking passes at the island's stores. The passes are needed to park at the island's beaches and trailheads, which are especially popular in the summertime. The Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife decided to stop selling physical books of permits to local stores last summer, and instead, people need to buy a permit online and print it out. They say the old system was costly, outdated, and didn't match with federal requirements for these licenses. Local store owners worry how the change will impact business. Parking permits meant a reason for visitors and tourists to visit the stores, and the stores made $2 each for each pass they sold. The online-to-print permit system will be a big shift for visitors, too. The Fish and Wildlife Department issued a new policy in September that allows people to write out their permit number on a paper and place that on their dashboard. But cell service can be unreliable on Sovie Island. And state troopers seem unsure if they would honor those digits as a parking pass, according to Oregon Live. Some of the island's stores may still have some parking permits left from old books, which will be honored through 2025.
Climate change threatens habitats that many endangered species need to thrive. So conservation efforts must take climate change into account when protecting habitats. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. To protect endangered species, it's critical to know the specific habitat they need. For example, the desert tortoise requires hot, dry conditions, but not so hot and dry that the flowers it eats wither and die. So when a federal agency lists a species as threatened or endangered, it maps areas that provide what's called critical habitat. The designation helps guide conservation efforts.
But most critical habitat was developed without thinking about climate change.
Ted Weber of the nonprofit Defenders of Wildlife says drought, heat, and sea level rise are transforming many areas.
What may have been suitable habitat in the past may not be suitable habitat in the future.
His research shows that many species' designated critical habitats overlap little with maps of climate refugia, places that are less vulnerable to climate impacts, and they mostly lack protected corridors that would help species move as the climate warms.
So that means that unless changes are made, so for example, incorporating more climate refugia and corridors, these species may not survive into the next century.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
Scientists say that California residents and developers need to prepare communities now for the next wave of urban wildfire. As Mark Richardson reports, even bigger wildfires are in the future, so people need to adapt.
The final numbers from January's wildfires in Southern California were jaw-dropping. At least 29 dead, 200,000 people evacuated, and more than 18,000 structures destroyed. As rebuilding begins, experts say there are steps homeowners and urban planners should take to minimize the destruction from future fires. Nick Link with the National Center for Ecological Analysis and Synthesis says communities should see rebuilding as an opportunity to avoid past mistakes.
An ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. Rather than writing a blank check, which we're going to have to start doing more and more often for more and more communities, what if we invested a little bit up front and created more of the space? And that's something that land managers have been advocating for a long time.
Link says communities should incorporate fire smart strategies and infrastructure, require vegetation-free buffers or fire breaks, mandate fire-resistant building materials such as double-pane windows, and offer incentives to owners who rebuild using these strategies. Planners say preventing flying embers from drifting into vulnerable openings in a home can prevent the structure from being destroyed. Alexandra Sifford with the Conservation Biology Institute says in fires like those in the Los Angeles area, homes tended to burn from the inside out.
They send in a wind gust of 70, 80 miles an hour, and these little tiny millions of little embers are flying through the air that can jump 10-lane freeways. Whatever those little embers land on or can get into is the big reason that people lose their houses in fire.
Link adds the beauty of living in wooded areas can also be the most significant danger.
You can see in a wildfire like the one that burned through LA, they don't know who from who. It's a wildfire coming through. It doesn't matter who you are, what you think, how you feel. This is a problem that we're all going to face, and it'll become a bigger issue both as the climate warms up and as we continue to expand into that wild and urban interface.
For California News Service, I'm Mark Richardson.
Some 40% of Americans experience seasonal affective disorder in the darker winter months, but there are ways to combat it. Eric Galatis spoke with an expert from the University of Colorado to learn more.
Nearly 4 in 10 Americans say they feel gloomy during colder, darker months, according to a recent American Psychiatric Association study. But there are ways to shake these winter blues. UC Health clinical psychologist Dr. Justin Ross says a big reason people feel down is lack of sunlight, a critical source of vitamin D. And colder temperatures also make heading outdoors less inviting.
We lose energy. We may feel a little bit cognitively fuzzy. We have a tendency to stay indoors.
And it sort of perpetuates this cycle of just feeling kind of blah for a period of up to several months at a time.
Ross recommends soaking up whatever sunshine is available for at least 30 minutes early in the day. On cloudy days, aim to be outdoors for up to an hour. If the winter blues develop into something more serious and interfere with your daily life, if you're not able to perform at work or school, or if you're withdrawing from family and friends, Hart recommends reaching out to a health professional for help. February is also a time when people begin to assess their New Year's resolutions, which can also dampen moods. Ross says a goal such as losing weight can seem overwhelming. Focus on the daily steps to get there, diet and exercise, which are 100% within your control.
They also are much more accomplishable on a daily basis. So recommitting to behaviors that you have within your control is a really important strategy, not only for managing those resolutions, but also for thinking about combating those wintertime blues.
Ross also points to the Scandinavian concept of hygge, the art of cozy winter living. Sip your favorite warm beverage from a beautiful mug, read a book in a comfy chair, snuggle up with someone under a blanket by fire or candlelight, settle into activities that are slow, quiet, and still.
And what those Scandinavian countries tend to really focus on is, you know, embracing that and finding a way to celebrate that through comfort and coziness and connection to one another just in a different way.
This is Eric Galatis for the Colorado News Connection.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, February 17th, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our producer and engineer for tonight's newscast is Althea Billings. Special thanks to Isabel Charlet, Antonia Gonzalez, Mark Richardson, Eric Galatis, Alex Gonzalez, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philamath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Kate Chase.
And I'm Sam Bowman.